NASA's space shuttle program was retired after 5 decades that brought significant advancements and discoveries in science, medicine, and technologies. What seemed like science fiction to many of us in our youth became reality. What will replace the shuttle program, and where is the American space program headed? Today, we sit down with former astronaut Pierre Sellers, who is a veteran of 3 spaceflights. He's the deputy director of the Science and Exploration Directorate at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. You've got a long business card, don't you?
I tell you, it barely fits. It's not a dictatorate. It's a directorate.
Thank you.
I'd like it to be a dictatorate sometimes.
That would be good, wouldn't it?
That's right.
All right.
Respect.
So, well, you've kind of come full circle, starting out with your career with NASA at Goddard, studying climate change, right? And now you're back as deputy director, overseeing research on mission design for the space and earth sciences, including climate.
That's right. Right. That's right.
Yeah. So, before we get to the space.
I was a scientist, then an astronaut, and now I'm a bureaucrat.
There you go.
So I've stepped down each time.
So talk a little bit about your work in climate science. I guess one of the challenges that you had was to make better use of satellite data to enhance the
models. Well, where we are right now is we have a very large and capable fleet of satellites up there right now, and they're doing sterling work, you know, looking at the Earth, all aspects of climate, the ice sheets, the atmosphere, the ocean circulation, and all the biota. We can see an awful lot from up there. But a large fraction of that fleet is getting long in the tooth. Mm. So we're in the business of trying to replace those satellites and do new science in the next decade or so with a limited budget. Mm. So it's kind of a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, we're hacking away at it, doing the best we can.
Yeah, that limited budget really is.
Oh, yeah.
That's tough.
That makes you sit down and think.
Yeah. We've had some discussions on this program with some of the scientists who study things like salinity in the ocean. You know, we talk a lot about climate change here on this program. And a couple weeks ago, we had a scientist on who was talking about getting salinity readings from satellites. And the question is, how does a satellite tell us about ocean salinity?
Actually, it's satellite. The first satellite capable of doing this was launched last fall, in the autumn mm-hmm. of 2011, and went up there, smashing success. This thing uses, it looks at microwave radiation coming off the ocean surface. So it sort of measures the temperature of the ocean surface. And there's a particular little bit of physics that says that at some wavelength, some kind of radiation is greatly affected by the amount of salt in the very top thin surface layer of the water that you're looking at. So you look at 2 frequencies. One tells you how warm the water really is, the physical temperature. And the other frequency tells you how that temperature is affected just by the amount of salt in the water. Just a few grains of salt make all the difference in the world. And so there's this thing, you know, whirring around the world right now, measuring the sea surface salinity worldwide every day. Yeah. It's like a miracle.
What are some of the other things that were the data that satellites collecting besides salinity? What are some of the other things that it's...
Well, there's a lot of things that are kind of obvious that satellites have been doing for years but are still nonetheless very important. Things like cloudiness, the sea surface temperature. That's very important for understanding how the oceans work. The amount of green vegetation worldwide. We can do that very precisely from satellite, and we've been doing that for about 30 years as well. New and exciting things that we, you know, personally I didn't think were possible, we now have satellites that can measure little variations in the gravity field of the Earth. Mm. So we've got these satellites that chase each other around the world, and they can tell sort of dense bits of crust and thin bits of crust on the Earth, and also things like how much ice there is on top of the continents, and how much groundwater there is. So now we can effectively do things like measure the mass of ice on Greenland, mm-hmm. and we could see it melt in the summer, we could see it accumulate in the winter. We're actually weighing Greenland from space.
Amazing.
So you can see this stuff happening.
Yeah, so give us an idea of the role that satellites play in analyzing climate change throughout the years, because I mean, they've been up there for a while, but mm-hmm. obviously we can't go too far back. So tell us a little about the role and what we're learning.
Unfortunately, we never had the opportunity to launch wooden satellites, you know,
yeah,
100 years ago.
Yeah,
it would
so
have been
unfortunately,
nice.
Unfortunately, yeah, we don't
wooden,
have that
wooden
data.
Wooden brass satellites, Victorian ones, would be great. Well, you know, it's at most a 30-year record, you know, the satellite mm-hmm. era. However, the world has changed a lot in 30 years, so there's some things we can see. One of the most obvious things that you can see from space is the decrease in the Arctic ice sheet, you know, the little sort of raft of ice that sits at the North Pole. Mm-hmm. And every summer, that's been getting smaller and smaller over the last 15 years, and we've been seeing it from mm-hmm. space using a radiometer. So that's something that we can measure with very high precision, and we've seen it decline over the period of record, 15 years.
Yikes. All right, so where along the way did you say to yourself, I think I want to be an astronaut?
Oh, that was early on. You know, I was about 7 years old. But I thought, this is great. Yeah, my dad was explaining to me about Yuri Gagarin and all that stuff. And I thought, wow, that's impressive. So I got, you know, addicted to the whole business of aerospace. And, you know, I'm one of the generation that was fortunate enough to see the whole lunar landing adventure, mm-hmm. which was tremendously exciting.
Right.
You know, very difficult thing to do, you know. A lot of people betting it couldn't be done, and there it was.
And there it was, right.
And I think that was one of the major motivators for me to study science at school. Mm-hmm. You know, benefited from great teachers and all that, but, you know, to see a wonderful scientific, technical adventure going on while you're growing up, you know, it's motivating.
Right, so you become a biometeorologist.
Yes.
And so you're studying, the, you know, as we've mentioned, this climate change, and you say, okay, I think now's the time I want to be an astronaut. And the problem was, you were British, and you have to be an American citizen to be an American astronaut. So you actually became an American citizen as part of your quest to be an astronaut.
Well, yeah, but not only that. I was working as a civil servant for the U.S. government, a civil servant scientist, trying to, you know, understand how to use satellites to look at climate and biology on the Earth's surface. So they said, hey, if you want to be a civil servant, you really ought to become a citizen. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy to do that.
Right.
Proud to be an American.
Yep.
And proud to be an expert too.
Yep.
And so that really wasn't much of a wrench.
Yeah. All right. So you become an astronaut. You've been studying climate. And one of your biggest surprises once you get into space is how thin the atmosphere is.
That's right. Yeah. We were talking about that last night. Mm-hmm. And it's peculiar that I've spent so much of my life studying the atmosphere, how it works, making little models of it on computers, looking at satellite data and all the rest of it. And I was shocked. I mean, I was really shocked when I got into orbit and I looked at the Earth's limb, and there's the curve of the Earth, and there's this like onion skin of atmosphere there. I mean, so thin. There's the world that's 8,000 miles across, you know, diameter. And the atmospheres that you can see is about 25 miles. It's nothing. It's almost nothing. So that was kind of an epiphany for me.
Yeah.
And it immediately becomes obvious when you see that it's such a small volume of air that we live and breathe in and work in that's very easily affected by what we do.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you had to know this. I mean, you've heard this, but until you see it, was it just having to really see it with your own eyes for it to sink in?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You had to have the personal sense of scale, the personal experience, really, for it to lodge.
Right.
And it did.
Your last space mission was aboard the Atlantis, May 2010.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the end of the shuttle program?
Well, I feel good. it was a very tricky, sophisticated technology. It was a real leap in technology at the time to make this thing. You know, they designed it in the 70s and built it in the 80s. Remarkable machine. I mean, the most complicated machine that humans have ever made, no question. 3 million parts in each shuttle. 3 million parts, most of which have to work pretty well if you're going to get up there and back safely. So this wonderful machine accomplished a lot, but it's very expensive to operate. And so I, for one, was very happy once it had accomplished its major mission, which is the completion of the build of space station, that, you know, we could retire the program. It's a good time to stop and go on and do something else.
Mm. We're talking with Pierce Sellers, former astronaut, and our toll-free number, if you have a question or a comment, is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. When we think back to the 1960s and 70s and the space race, it's kind of remarkable to look at where we are today with the space station and people from all over the world sharing this space in space. Who would have thought, you know, back when it was like, who's going to get there first, the Russians or the Americans? And here we are now all working together.
Yeah, and I think it's a very satisfying evolution. Without the space race, we wouldn't have got to the moon within 10 years. There's no question about it. I think we'd probably still be talking about it,
right.
You know, and not going. So that whole thing propelled the technology into a completely new, you know, game space. But now where we are is very satisfying. You've got 17 countries collaborating in building the space station. And it's turned out, you know, in spite of many critics early on in the program. It's turned out to be a smashing success. For example, when we were temporarily out of the space launch business after the Columbia accident, you know, 2.5 years we were stood down. Hey, there was the Russian side ready to fill the gap in terms of getting supplies up there and keeping station going. So it was good to have, you know, alternate paths to station.
What do you think, though, about our status as of leaders in the space program? The plan to replace the shuttle program with the Constellation program was put on hold. Again, we're talking budget mm-hmm. stuff here. Right now, American astronauts are basically hitching a ride with the Russians to get up there. So what do you see the future of America's space program? What do you see us heading?
I think it's easier to talk about the long term than the midterm. In the midterm, you know, we're definitely going to keep station going. And it's certified to at least 2020, and I'm betting it'll go through 2025 or even later. So we'll have traffic continuously toing and froing to space station, probably using commercial vehicles sometime in the next few years. The long-term goal, I think, for most people in the business would be, you know, Mars. Mm-hmm. We want to see human exploration of Mars. But it's doubtful that we'll have people going there until the 2030s. It takes a lot of work. It's a long way. Right. And there's a lot of problems to overcome. But I think that's something we could all look forward to, is seeing people ultimately get to Mars.
What about the commercial aspect, using commercial, space flights? Is it safe, do you think? I mean, are there concerns about when you have a commercial venture, bottom line is usually, dictates a lot of what happens. Are you worried about, cutting costs and using, this part instead of that part? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Actually, I'm not so concerned.
No?
No, not really. If you look at most of the private companies that make rockets for NASA right now, they do the best they can. And NASA provides an awful lot of oversight. And then, with all the checking and watching and stuff, you can add a lot to the cost for each launch. With the commercial sector, there's still going to be quite a lot of oversight from NASA for any rockets that we use. But the provider is going to have more freedom, I think, to, in terms of how they actually go about business and be able to save a lot of money. And we're sort of seeing that with SpaceX right now.
Right.
SpaceX should be able to provide us with cheaper access to space, right?
Yeah. So do you see more civilians traveling to space then?
Well, I'm a civilian.
I was a government
employee.
Yeah.
Working for the government one way or another was a prerequisite for getting into space,
right.
Pretty much. Yeah, I would think so. I would see, it'll be mainly billionaires going to orbit in the near future, so keep saving.
Actually, I don't think they could pay me enough to go up there,
Really?
I would be scared to death.
I think you would love it.
Would love the view.
Then the floating bit. I think it'd all be very exciting, and I think you'd love it. Most people. I'd like to take all my friends. I really would.
Yeah.
I think they'd all like it.
Describe what it's like, especially that first time you take off. You're sitting there and you're waiting, the countdown has started.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what was going through your head the very first time you went up?
Absolutely. So there you are. I was sort of lying on my back in the cockpit of Atlantis. This was in 2002 now. So you're watching anxiously through the windows to see if the clouds will get out of the way so it'll be clear to launch. It was our third attempt. And you're looking at all the little dials and numbers clicking down, taking you closer and closer to the moment of launch. And then sort of about 10 minutes before launch, it dawns on you that we're really going to do it today. The sort of tempo changes in the voices of the controllers and all the people you can hear. You could tell them doing the switchover from we're just going through a normal count exercise to, oh my goodness, we're really going to fire this thing off. And then, it's like electricity. Everyone's concentrating really tightly, looking at the numbers come down. And then total reality is 4 seconds before launch, you feel the engines light up beneath you and the whole structure shake. The whole rocket shakes, swing forward under the strain. The solid rocket boosters fire up and off you go.
Oh. And you're mashed into your seat.
Mashed into your seat. It's like a bomb going off underneath your backside. You just get pushed up into the sky. You see the launch tower just whiz by you past the window pane. And then you're just thundering uphill, into the sky. Faster and faster and faster. A lot of noise, a lot of vibration, a lot of excitement.
How fast
Tremendous.
Are you going?
Well, 1 minute after launch, you're going through the sound barrier, but straight up. 2 minutes after launch, you're 25 miles high, 25 miles above the surface of the Earth and above most of the atmosphere, and you're going five times the speed of sound. So you're screaming.
That's amazing.
You're going two and a half times as fast as a bullet 2 minutes after launch.
So you go from that mashed into your seat to what?
Well, you keep doing that for about 8 minutes, and then when it's really beginning to get a bit tiresome, you know, you're being crushed into your seat at 3G. The main engine's cut off because you've achieved orbital speed. They cut off and they go from full thrust to nothing in a fraction of a second. And you go from being squished into your seat under 3G to being completely weightless in a fraction of a second.
It's gotta be the weirdest feeling.
It's the weirdest sensation. You kind of rock forward in your straps. And everything that was kind of pressed against the surface under the G-force starts floating and bobbing around like it's an aquarium.
Yeah, wow.
And you think, this is really interesting. You let go of your pencil and it starts doing little somersaults.
Yeah. See, that part I wouldn't mind. I don't know if I'd like that pushed into my seat thing.
And then you look out the window.
Yeah, that
would
be cool.
And there's the Earth scooting by at 5 miles a second. Very pretty.
Dana is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Dana.
Hello, thank you to both of you. I'm really fascinated by this, and I'm certainly all for exploring the cosmos as far as, out there, unquote, as we can get. But I am a little concerned about the privatization of space travel. First of all, the narrative of the self-starting innovator really doesn't hold water when NASA, whose budget is being slashed, is still partially funding SpaceX and others. I'm also concerned about the commodification and monopolizing of access to space, especially if it goes into private hands. I really think this is something the government should be doing as representatives of we the people. And I really think NASA should get its budget back up there.
All right. Dana, let's respond.
Well, Dana, thanks for calling in. Well, you bring up a couple of points. I think the first thing, you know, is an important one, the relationship between these commercial providers and the government. Right now, NASA, U.S. government, is sort of contracting with these commercial providers to provide us with a service, which is, to wit, you know, flying supplies up to space station and probably sometime soon flying people up and back. We can't forget that right now we're in the business of contracting with the Russians to provide a lot of this service, which, while convenient, is not ideal. We'd like to see a U.S. Workforce providing us with that help. So right now it's sort of total government contract. In the out years, I would expect there to be a private space sector that's doing things like tourism and other work out there. But I would always imagine that there'll be a U.S. government-led exploration effort. It's the U.S. government that, after all, will be taking us to Mars. I think very much doubt that a private commercial venture would want to do that.
That's a tough task. I mean, people don't realize that's a tough task.
It's a tough task, and it's something that, you know, that the majority of taxpayers would want to see and pay for, I'm guessing, as a government effort. Mm-hmm. You know.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Dana. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. All right, so you're looking down at Earth, and you're getting that view that most of us see photos of. But don't forget,
it's all moving past you very quickly.
Right. Yeah. But even when you're up there in the space station, I mean, looking down at Earth, it has to be just I look at the photo and it's a kind of an awesome experience. I can't imagine what it would be like to be doing that firsthand. So you look down and you see the Earth. And does your perspective change?
Well, first of all, you know, I spent hours and hours looking out the window when I was allowed to, my off hours. And it never gets old.
Yeah.
And the first thing you notice is that, you know, the Earth is really curved. It's not just curved left to right, you know, horizon that way, but it's curved from you towards the horizon. Mm. You are looking at the surface of a ball.
I gotcha.
Right. Now, and on the sun side of the Earth, it's very, very bright. It's so bright it hurts your eyes. If you're at high altitude, you know, on a sunny day, and it's, you know, you have to squint because of the light on snow and all the rest of it. It's that bright. So the Earth almost looks like it's glowing because of the bright sunlight reflected off it. It's just beautiful. Every detail. You can see all the little clouds, the mountains, the rivers, everything. Just perfect. The next thing you notice is it looks like somebody is rolling this ball underneath you. You're stationary in your spacecraft, but somebody is rolling this ball underneath you because you don't have any feeling of motion sitting there in your spacecraft. You're floating weightless.
Right.
And it looks like someone's rotating the world underneath you. So at the end of that, to get to your question about does it change your perspective, it does a bit. It really makes you realize the world is a finite, small place. 7 billion people down there, mm-hmm. you know, 6 people up there. It's a very small place. It's completely finite. And the resources are limited.
Yeah. Well, so, I asked you that because we've had astronaut Sunita Williams on the program, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said something about when she looked down, she said, you don't see the borders. You know, it's all one place. You know, we happen to, you know, when you're here, you think, well, it's this country and that country or this town and that. But it really, you get up there and it's one place.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. It's one ball with its own little atmosphere and it's rolling around the sun. Yeah. And all now, 7 billion of us down here.
Yeah. Now, when you were up there in your last flight up there, May 2010, we had the BP oil spill mm-hmm. in the Gulf of Mexico. And you could clearly see that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You could see this thing 300 miles across, covering a big chunk of the Gulf of Mexico. A real mess. It looked like a big giant whirlpool, really, long strings of crude oil mm-hmm. with a sheen in between them. You can see a lot from up there. Not just oil spills, deforestation, volcanoes, all the little things that you read about in the press, you mm-hmm. can actually see with your naked eye from up there.
Amazing. Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Joel.
Hi. You being a biologist and an astronaut, I was curious whether you know of any group or agency, the name thereof, of who might possibly be trying to correlate the physical data that you are collecting and the population growth of the world. I know that the time is probably way too short to have accumulated anything of significance, but I was curious whether anybody is in that endeavor.
Well, there's a couple of efforts that have spun off from NASA data that are kind of interesting in that regard. One is that we have satellites that have been taking data at nighttime all around the world, and we've put together images of all the city lights around the world. And so we can see the extent of the city lights growing. So we have a pretty good handle on how quickly the cities are expanding around the world. The other thing is that we have satellites that can tell you a lot about the arable cropland around the world and how that's changing. So we can tell you something about food supply, which I guess tells you something about population. Can't really measure population directly from space, but you can see the impacts of an increasing population.
Since 2000, there have been people continuously living at the space station. It's 6 people at a time, thereabouts, and they're 6-month stints.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So is that 6-month period dictated on some of the health effects of living in space? I mean, you lose calcium, there's exposure to radiation. Is there any correlation to be that amount of time that you're spending up there and...
Actually not.
No. Oh.
The main reason why 6 months is a good time to do it is that the Soyuz spacecraft mm-hmm. Has a time that it can spend on orbit of just over 6 months.
I gotcha.
So it brings a crew up, mm-hmm. they jump out, and they go back in the same spacecraft. And the spacecraft is good for 6 months and a little bit more.
Oh, interesting.
So the certification of that drives the rotation.
So what about the study of what health impacts there are for the people up at the space station? I'd mentioned the calcium, and I think we've mentioned that before in the program, but go ahead and tell people what that is.
Yeah, your bones, your skeleton basically responds to all the impacts that you give every day, walking around, jumping, sitting. The load that you put on your bones tells your body where to put the calcium. So when you're floating around in space, there is very little impact, very little load on your skeleton. So we found out very early on in the program that we were losing a lot of calcium from your skeleton as soon as you got to orbit. Mm. And sometimes people would come back from space and they'd lost 20% of the calcium in their bones. So very
That's
weak bones.
Lot.
They got bone fractures.
Wow.
No kidding. Stuff like that. So as a countermeasure now, we exercise the heck out of people on orbit. They pound away on the treadmills and do all sorts of other things. We're finding this to be kind of effective countermeasure. So we're working on that.
What about the exposure to radiation?
That one is a much tougher nut to crack. When you're flying around a space station, it's equivalent to getting about 2 chest x-rays a day.
Wow.
Which is something.
Yeah.
But that is a low load compared to if you travel away from the Earth into interplanetary space. then you get lots of very hard radiation. It's called the galactic cosmic radiation. It's very hard, very energetic, very damaging. And we don't really know what to do about that yet.
Yeah, so that's something we're working on.
We're working on it.
I mean, another interesting thing I hadn't thought about was space debris.
I
didn't realize this, but so we monitor... NORAD monitors space debris that's bigger than what's the size?
About the size of, I don't know, a ping pong ball or
so
a little bit larger than
bigger than that.
Anything bigger than that, the air defense people can see on a radar and they can tell you where it's going to be, you know, a few hours or days from now. So they've been very helpful in allowing the manned space program to avoid hitting anything really large over the last 20 years. However, there's a lot of things smaller than that that they can't see that could really make your eyes water if it hit you.
Yeah.
And
more than your eyes.
That's
knock
right.
Your hands,
yes. Right. And so, you know, that's just a statistical risk you have to put up with.
Yeah. And you've been on a number of spacewalks, so you've been out there. Mm-hmm. Do you worry about that when you're, you know, you're doing some, you're concentrating on whatever your job is, moving things around, which was interesting with the weightlessness. You can pick up these huge, like 400-pound batteries and nothing.
With
right?
one hand.
One hand, yeah.
The
finger, if you want.
That's right.
But do you, when you're out there, are you thinking, oh boy, I got to watch out for some of this little space debris that might come by? And
not really.
No?
I mean, you know, the odds are very small of getting whacked by something like that. So you don't worry about it too much. And in any case, the whole thing is too thrilling to waste on worry. Mm-hmm. You're too excited exactly about what you were talking about. The fact that you can get a 400-pound or in some cases a 1,200-pound object and quietly pull it from one place and slowly move it somewhere else and park it somewhere else. Yeah. It's just incredible.
And we see a lot of videos from the space station of you guys having a whole bunch of fun, but it's really a lot of work. You're working most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
So that those fun moments are not...
Fun videos we had to choreograph and you know, think about it beforehand so we could get it all done in like half an hour.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we do have fun. But for the most part, you know, astronauts have to work very hard because, you know, so much effort and money goes into the time on orbit. So we're working really hard.
Right. Pierre Sellers, it was great fun having you here. Thanks for coming in. We hope you'll come visit us again sometime.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah, Pierre Sellers, a veteran of three spaceflight. He's Deputy Director of the Science and Exploration Directorate at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Tridle and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.